Chevy.net.
Antique and vintage cars, trucks, street rods, military vehicles, muscle cars, early brass era, and beautiful classics from the 20s and 30s. See them all at the 57th Annual Stowe Antique and Classic Car Meet, August 8th through the 10th. This year's show will feature a special tribute to the legendary Woodies of all eras, makes, and models. And don't miss the vintage fashion judging competition Saturday morning and the world-famous antique car parade Saturday afternoon at 3:30. The big street dance is on Main Street in Stowe Village from 7 to 10 p.m. Judging and award presentations take place on Sunday. There's a Vermont crafters tent and a huge automotive flea market and collector cars for sale at the Car Corral all weekend. It's the Stowe Antique and Classic Car Meet Friday through Sunday, August 8th through the 10th on Nichols Field, Route 100. Admission is $10, seniors only $8, kids 12 and under are admitted free. A presentation of the Vermont Auto Enthusiasts.
It's time to get the story behind the story. Interviews with newsmakers, newsbreakers, and your phone calls. Radio Vermont presents The Mark Johnson Show.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program. Thanks for tuning in. Another gorgeous day today. Aren't you getting sick and tired of me saying that? Thanks for spending part of your morning with us. Coming up in about 25 minutes here, we're going to be chatting with Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott. He's among the Republican leaders who are critical of the Shumlin administration when it comes to health care reform, in particular the website. So we'll chat with him on what his side of the aisle sees as the better route to have gone. We'll take your phone calls throughout the program as well. We can chat a little bit about Ed Snowden, just got granted another 3 years in Russia. A couple of other interesting items as well, too. By the way, would love to get a question or two from you for Senator Leahy. I'm going to be interviewing him tonight on Vermont Public Television, Vermont PBS, 8 o'clock tonight. So if you want to put one of those either in an email to me at mark, M-A-R-K, at gmavt.net, or you can also put it up on my Facebook page or our program Facebook page, too. Appreciate that. All right, 244-1777 is our local number. Toll-free, 877-291-8255. We're going to begin this morning and talk a little bit about mushroom farming. And who better to discuss that than the author of a book on that topic? Let's give a nice warm Radio Vermont welcome this morning to Trad Cotter, who is the author of Organic Mushroom Farming. Trad, good morning.
Everybody. How's it going? Good morning.
How are you? Are we going to be talking over each other the entire interview? Uh-oh.
Absolutely.
Oh,
I'm going to try.
You know, I can't wait to get you actually back on the program a second time. You know why?
Why's that?
So then I can say, welcome back, Cotter.
I've never heard that before.
Oh, my gosh. I'm sure you never have. So, all right, let's take care of one piece of confusion that I have. It's called mycologist. I thought people that collected mushrooms were called mycophagists.
It's a little bit of the same. Mycophagy is a love or a mushroom collector. Mycology is the study of fungi. So I think by default, anybody who's involved in mycophagy is a mycologist or amateur mycologist. So they're kind of interchangeable.
Okay. All right. As long as it all and begins with myco, it sounds like it's pretty much in the mushroom family.
Sure. Myco, anything. You just type it in. So anything with a fungus.
Why'd you get interested in this?
Why? I kind of fell into mushroom cultivation. I wasn't really interested in fungi at all, and I was hired as a walk-in at a mushroom farm, doing a tour of all things. So I really knew nothing about them. I wasn't really into eating them. And 20-some-odd years ago, I was just touring a farm in Charleston and just got hired on the spot and was put in charge of production of this high-tech facility at, 20 years old. So
wow.
It was quick and easy. I mean, overnight, production manager and, quote, mushroom expert, but, just quickly at a very young age, just thrown into the fire.
Wow. Sounds like a high school kid who showed up at the Dallas Cowboys and got, next thing you know, his starting quarterback.
Yeah, it was quite a twist of fate, and when I look back at that, it was just in the right place at the right time. And, a similar situation happened at our farm now, history repeating itself, where this young girl called and we were putting out an ad for, a production manager. And she called ahead of the ad even going out and just said, heard about you guys, and she walked in, and now she's in charge of my production. So, you know, we're very lucky to be in this type of business and be able to go out and share the knowledge, which is what the book is all about.
Tell me about your farm.
The farm now is growing like a mushroom, if we're going to keep the jokes simple.
Mm-hmm.
And it is now moved to a 26-acre facility, and we're located in the upstate South Carolina.
Okay. All right.
40,000 square feet of lab space and growing space.
Mm-hmm.
We have a tissue culture laboratories. For anybody listening not knowing what that is, we can isolate mushrooms from the wild and just take small pieces of tissue and expand them into millions of mushrooms in just a few weeks.
You're kidding.
No.
Wow.
When I do tours, people are just blown away. They're like, you know, they see all the Petri plates, and you know, the farm is tourable, and not many mushroom farms are the way this one's set up. But you can actually see into the lab like an aquarium, and each Petri plate in about 11 weeks can grow 1 million pounds of mushrooms.
Oh, my God, you're kidding me.
No way. I mean, it is magic. they talk about magic mushrooms. They are truly magical.
So how many different varieties of mushrooms are you growing?
Well, we grow about 20 to 30 types of edible mushrooms that people would, I think, recognize by name. I have over 200 species in the lab that I maintain for food or for different applications. So, you know, medical applications, industrial. We've got some cultures that are killing fire ants, you know, pesticidal, biopesticide-type things to replace chemicals. So we've got a very large collection, and we keep adding to it. So every time we go out into the wild, we collect, and we find something, and mushrooms are doing unusual things in nature, and we'll remove those from, you know, the wild and clone them and put them into production and see what they can do.
Wow. So do you find new varieties of mushrooms?
We do. We do all the time. Currently, we're not set up for DNA, but we will very soon. We'll be doing our own DNA extractions, but we collect and see things all the time. And, you know, it's like deep sea fish. You never know what you're going to get, and a lot of them are undocumented, so you go out, there's probably 4,000 to 5,000 mushroom species in my area.
Oh my gosh.
And you know, you open up a field guide and there's a couple hundred, you know, that's all that's photographed and described. So, I mean, the chances are very high of going out and not finding anything that's been documented. And most people who go out picking, they'll just, if they don't recognize it as something that's edible, they'll just either leave it or they'll pick it and just throw it away. So I think a lot of species have been discovered and discarded.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Trad Cotter. He's the author of Organic Mushroom Farming. So can you tell me, what are some mushrooms that are used for legitimate medical purposes?
Legitimate medical purposes. Right now, I know the listeners will probably know what oyster mushrooms are and shiitake mushrooms.
Yeah.
Those are what I would call edible medicinals, along with maitake, which is hen of the woods. And these are mushrooms that when you consume them, they are low in cholesterol, providing a very strong or high dose of vitamin D. They are blood and sugar regulating molecules in these mushrooms, and just by ingesting them, you will impart those types of, quote, medical response or immune support
mm-hmm.
response. Legitimate science with the oyster mushrooms, which is very common, and I know they grow in your area, are being used in some of the first human AIDS trials. So what
wow.
they'll do is disrupt and prevent viral replication of the HIV virus, which is pretty phenomenal.
Wow, that is amazing. If you have any comments or questions, you can join us at 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. Sorry, you were going to say something else.
And other legitimate studies, too. I know we were talking about how magical mushrooms are. There are using the different, quote, magic mushrooms at Johns Hopkins University with some really good results with cancer patients, addictive behaviors, OCD, PTSD, one dose. So anyone who's interested in that research, go to John Hopkins University. Very good research on that.
And these are psychedelic mushrooms?
They are, but at these doses that they're doing, they're moderated doses and settings done by psychotherapists. You know, they're doing this research. And one of the speakers is coming out to the Telluride Mushroom Festival to show the latest research. And some of this research is available if you go to the TED Talks and type in John Hopkins and search out that research. Very good talk, very compelling.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. Have you ever eaten a bad one?
No, and I teach mushroom identification, so we just are very careful. And I, you know, my motto when eating mushrooms is better safe than dead. And since I teach the rules of mushroom identification for the entire state. So you got to be careful. You got to learn them one at a time. You can generalize mushrooms into groups, but I've seen some very, old wives' tales rules, specifically from Europe, where you know if the quarter or silver penny turns black, then don't eat it. But there's no general rule for mushroom identification. So anyone listening, you know, there's mushroom groups everywhere. In the United States, and you can go to the North American Mycological Association website and find a local group and join that local group, and they will teach you everything there is to know about mushrooms in your area.
There was a high school teacher I had who made a he was a mycophagist and gave this presentation about if you die this way, it is supposed to be one of the most excruciating ways, and you wish you were dead in the second of the third day of excruciating pain.
That's probably a destroying angel, and there's death caps. Down here, we've got these big white destroying angels. I mean, they're gorgeous. They're beautiful mushrooms. They're symbiotic with trees, so they do a good thing for the environment. But the culprits are mostly dogs are eating these. And, you know, I'm the call, the toxicology call for this part of the state and region. Most of the calls are from veterinarians, so anyone who has a dog should probably familiarize themselves with the destroying angels or death caps in the area. It's a very easy mushroom to ID. And, you know, the top three mushrooms are, the top three groups that are poisoned are dogs, and number two is toddlers. You know, who are crawling on lawns and eating little brown mushrooms.
Yeah.
And the third group is college students. Just by chance.
Huh. Well, how would you explain that, Trad?
Just being experimental mushrooms that they might pick up on campus, if you know what I'm saying. They're maybe misidentifying or not for their recreational purposes. So, you know, people who are picking mushrooms and not knowing what they are, you know, run a risk, especially if you're getting from someone you don't know. But legitimate mushroom poisonings, everyone listening should cook their mushrooms. And I get that a lot from the toxicology chair. He keeps saying that some of the mushrooms are just slightly toxic raw. And because they're made of chitin, mushrooms are made of a mineral, and we can't digest them with our enzymes in our gut. So we might think we're being poisoned, but it's really just indigestion. And a lot of the toxicology reports are just simply indigestion, where the person did not cook the mushrooms thoroughly. So that goes right back to the question I always get is, what about the salad bar mushrooms?
Right.
You know, I eat those all the time.
Yeah.
Cook them. That's one of the problems, is you shouldn't be eating raw mushrooms, period.
Really?
So,
Really. I've never heard that before.
Yeah. And being an organism that made of chitin, all the wonderful protein and those medicinal compounds I was talking about, they're braided together, and by cooking them, that softens that matrix, and it loosens up all the wonderful protein and vitamin D, and it makes it bioavailable for your body. Otherwise, it's just, when you eat raw mushrooms, you run the risk of being not poisoned, but you'll get indigestion, and number two, your body can't access all that wonderful nutrients as a food product. So it just kind of passes through.
Mm-hmm. How long do you have to cook mushrooms before that's effective?
Just until they're soft. Like a quick flash searing to heat them, even steaming, anything to do that, and just rolling them. Just not to the buckyball state, you know, where they're
right.
Carbon.
Right. Let's talk about growing mushrooms. So where is your farm again? What state?
We're in South Carolina, but we're away from the coast. We're right at the foothills of the mountains.
Okay.
We grow our laboratory, turns out the starter cultures for a lot of other farms, but we also grow shiitake mushrooms on these little sawdust blocks, a lot of those, and oyster mushrooms of many different colors, and maitake, enoki. We have a very large inventory of gourmet mushrooms. We also grow some medicinal mushrooms that are not directly edible. They're bitter, or they are hard and corky, like reishi mushrooms and turkey tails.
Mm-hmm.
They're very common in the woods, but they're definitely they have more of a cardboard-like flavor.
Yum!
It doesn't go over well.
Mm-hmm.
And so we make ethanol extracts out of those and put them into different products. So
you make an ethanol extract out of it?
Yeah. I know listeners have probably seen these little dropper bottles at the health food store, and it has, you know, the different herbs, herbal extracts, and medicinal extracts. You can find them at any health food store.
Yeah.
But you can take any edible mushroom that has reported, you know, medicinal properties. You can do shiitake, you can do turkey tail, it doesn't matter. But if you put it in a blender, put some ethanol over it, which is like Everclear, very strong food grade alcohol, and blend it, and you make this like mushroom slurpee, and then you leave it in a jar for 2 weeks, that all those compounds that are locked into that matrix I was telling you about, they become available into the ethanol. So it just floats inside that fluid, and then you can just, you know, use a couple drops of that a day in your orange juice or coffee, whatever, tea. It's a very easy way of making a medicinal mushroom extract, and all the details are in the book. We did a pretty thorough coverage of making your own extracts in there with a lot of conversions. That'll save some people some money, you know, who are buying that at the store. So a little
mm-hmm.
1 ounce dropper bottle is $30 to $40.
Mm. Wow.
So, yeah.
Wow. Huh. Do you grow most of your mushrooms outside or inside?
We grow them inside, and a lot of growers grow them outdoors on logs and stumps and wood chips, and we do that too for displays. We sell a lot of that type of spawn. But the controlled environment, if you're going to be consistent, we get that steady temperature, so there's no fluctuation.
Right.
And we maintain about 60, maybe 68 degrees in our growing room. And we'll, space is about 6,000 square feet, just one growing room, but we've got 42,000 square feet that we have available that we haven't grown into yet.
Wow!
So, yeah, it's really neat. The new location is just it's going to be a destination. You know, the signs went up this week. It's tourable. You know, it's like an amusement park. It's like a mushroom zoo.
Mm-hmm. Do you dream about mushrooms?
I'm sorry?
Do you dream about mushrooms?
Yeah, I do, actually. I do all the time, and I write about it in my book a lot, is that I really try to convince the readers to think like a mushroom. And, you know, I'm culturing mushrooms in my sleep. I'm picking them in my sleep. I'm thinking of different ways to use them, so my research continues, seems to continue when my eyes shut, you know, it just won't turn off.
Yeah.
Now, you know, we have a new baby here in the house, and that's definitely disrupted that process.
Yeah.
So, having the lab, we used to have our lab in the house when we were starting out, so it was very difficult to sleep, and I was always thinking of different projects and solutions with fungi. We do remediation a lot, and so we use mushrooms to break down different pollutants. And there's so many things going on in the fungal kingdom right now that it's hard to not think about it.
Wow.
So, yeah, wow. It really is.
You didn't name the baby like, you know, shiitake or anything, did you?
No, it wasn't even on the list.
Okay.
Chanterelle, maybe. Maybe Chanterelle was there, but all of our pets have, you know, we have a dog named Shroomy, you know. It wasn't going to go that route and be a cliche, so.
Yeah.
Her name's, you know, her middle name's Hazel, Heidi Hazel. And as far as I've gone with the mushrooms, correlation is that we're planting hazelnut trees with a truffle fungus on them for our daughter to hopefully be able to dig up truffles with Shroomy,
mm-hmm.
the dog who's been trained to find the truffles in about 5 years. It takes about 5 years, so.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
What kind of dog is, what kind of dog?
Shroomy is a lab, and labs, German Shepherds, those type of dogs, like very work obedient dogs, are very good at finding truffles. So, you know, we have these little pecan truffles down here, and dogs can be trained to find them. And in Europe, you know, they use pigs. Yeah, you know, you'll see.
Right.
You'll see these old, you know, old locals wandering around the woods with pigs on leashes.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're doing is just they're looking for the truffles during the winter. And the truffles exude a male sex pheromone. So most of the truffle hunters are walking around with, you know, mature female pigs. And the pigs, when they can just really locate them and start rooting into the ground, and that's how you find truffles. But you can train your dog, but it has to be a certain breed of dog.
Mm-hmm. Tell me more about what is this, how can mushrooms be used to clean up pollution?
Yeah, that's called, again, with the myco lead-in, myco remediation. And just like bioremediation, it's a subunit of that. So it's cleaning up pollution, environmental contaminants, using fungi. And how that works is mushrooms have chemical keys. So fungi, their stomachs, you know, are on the outside of their body in nature,
mm-hmm.
and their keys are designed to unlock certain things like the wood or the trees, the leaves, the mulch. So when you're finding mushrooms in the wild, they have unlocked and eaten and made that material available to plants and bacteria and things. But what happens is in remediation, especially with chemicals, and I do a lot of herbicidal remediation, that the chemicals, the keys that mushrooms possess, are actually, they can misidentify man-made molecules just like they would in a plant. So they're really good at breaking down, you know, different chemical pollutants, you know, like herbicides, DDTs, dioxins, PCBs, chlorinated compounds.
Mm.
And our communities are loaded with this stuff. You know, every community in the U.S. has a Superfund site within 10 miles of their house. I mean, they're everywhere.
All right, but how does this work? Yeah. How do you use mushrooms? Is it in a spray? What's the delivery system?
I got you. Okay, so the easiest way to do, if it's a soil contaminant, you can overlay the area with, let's say, wood chips. And then you plant the fungus in the wood chips. And then what happens is it'll thread through all the wood chips. And then once it runs out of food, when mushrooms run out of food, they start to release an enzyme. And that's where the chemical keys are. So then you can water it and sweat it into soil. Right, so you're just kind of washing that fungus, the mycelium, which is what it's called.
Right.
And those chemical keys gravitate down into that contaminated soil, and it starts to unlock and break down those molecules safely. And they don't accumulate up into the mushroom at all. The only thing that goes into a mushroom would be a heavy metal. So if it's a chemical pollutant, like say if you have a chlorinated, you know, contaminated soil site, like a brownfield site, and you overlaid wood chips, and then mushrooms grew out of that site, chances are, if you test those mushrooms, they will not be contaminated, which is amazing. It's absolutely amazing.
Wow, that is amazing. Huh. How long would it take somebody like me, who knows nothing about this, to learn how to grow mushrooms inside?
Mushrooms indoors is a step up from outdoors. Now, oyster mushrooms would be my training wheels mushroom for you.
Okay.
Anyone starting out, oyster mushrooms can be grown. I think if you start with spawn, which is like a bread culture, it's already started. You can mix that in with some, cooked straw or different growing media. All you do is expand it. And there's very simple outline directions in the book that was just released.
Mm-hmm.
But yourself, anybody with no experience can grow oyster mushrooms within 3 to 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's really fast.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're
taking over the house, right?
Well, yeah. Welcome to my world. And
then I'm dreaming about it.
You can expand and perpetuate that culture as well. You can grow mushrooms on coffee grounds. I teach a class called Recycling and Composting with Mushrooms, which is, in our kitchen we've got 3 different recycling bins, and one of them is full of paper and cardboard.
Right.
And all that paper, 30 to 40% of households in the United States, 30 to 40% average, is paper or cardboard waste that's not being recycled. And you can soak that in hot water, cram it down into a plastic bin or bucket, and add this culture, and you'll get mushrooms in a month and a half from your waste in your house.
Wow.
Edible oyster mushrooms.
Wow.
It really is amazing.
Wow, that's wild. That really is wild.
It never gets old. It really doesn't.
Yeah.
And after 20 years, people will say, you just seem so excited when you talk. And I'm like, well, when you grow mushrooms for the first time, I don't know how you cannot get excited about something that doubles in size every day. You go to bed and you wave to your mushroom good night. It's a little baby one. And then you get up the next morning and it's huge, and plants don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
They just don't react like that.
Yeah. But your kid's going to do that.
That's right.
Yeah. You're going to wake up some morning, you're going to go, wow, you actually grew overnight.
Yeah. It's very leveling, to have Heidi here. And Olga, my wife, we all, it's a family business. And, we all work the labs, we do everything, we wear all the hats. So the mm-hmm. farm, between the orders and the laboratory and the production, we're all running around with our heads cut off, but we're used to it. We're used to it.
Yeah, I wonder what's going to happen when Heidi doesn't really like mushrooms.
She's going to have to leave the house.
Yeah, I think that's probably the case.
You're going to have to send her off.
Yeah, off to some other school in another town or something.
I don't know. She's been brainwashed pretty early.
Yeah, I would imagine it's probably in just about every food product you're serving her right now.
Yeah, we're waterboarding's on the list if she doesn't like them.
Okay, next. Yeah. There's a couple of intermediate steps before you get to that.
Yeah, Child Services is knocking at my door.
But I'm really proud of you that you didn't put, chanterelle or shiitake even on the short list. That was great restraint on your part.
Yeah, I mean, anybody who knows us, we have a, fairly good sense of humor. We love what we do, and, all the animals have names here. Chickens have names. So they're off, they're laying hens.
Uh-huh.
But it truly is a way of life. And anybody who wants to grow mushrooms is listening. I'm really, Chelsea Green, who's the publisher of the book, did a great job editing it and turning it into this cover-to-cover read, making it what I would call a very digestible,
nice
do-it-yourself guide. Like you said, how do I get started?
Mm-hmm.
And it is super easy. Growing mushrooms outdoors on logs, going back to your question, is the most easiest. So, shiitakes on logs, that's where I would start. For anybody who has access to trees, down trees after storms, and then oyster mushrooms indoors, very easy.
Mm-hmm.
On different types of waste.
Well, I'm just looking to get to the micro remediation part of the book so I can go and clean up the Gulf next time there's a big spill.
You know, we were called to go down and do some of that work, and a lot of magazines were interviewing us, and we just weren't prepared at that moment. And myself, like probably a lot of the listeners, when you turned on the news, or I had that website. Do you remember the live camera?
Yeah.
On the bottom of the ocean?
Oh, God, with the thing flowing out. That was awful.
Dude, yeah. I was just sitting there, and I was sick to my stomach. It was like Earth Day week, and I was just watching it, and I was getting upset. I was getting nauseous, and then I'm like, you know, there's nothing we can do. Everybody's watching this.
Yeah.
So my wife Olga and I said, listen, we got to do something. And we knew mushrooms are really good at what they did, and we've already trained mushrooms to eat oil. And so we put out a wanted mushrooms ad, like an old Western poster with a description of mushrooms that grow along the beach. And so what we're trying to do is get people off the couch and more of a community involvement, you know, to action.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it said, anyone can help the oil spill, you know, because I knew I was feeling helpless. Just get up and walk along the beaches and try to find mushrooms growing on the dunes, mangroves, driftwood, anything, because those are salt-tolerant mushrooms,
mm-hmm.
right? So we need salt-tolerant fungi if we're going to be absorbing oil using the absorbents and the booms and whatnot and bringing them back on land so we can actually use those cultures, those strains, to eat that oil that has a little bit of salt residue in it.
Wow.
So I don't think we're, you know, looking back, we weren't ready then, but we're ready now.
Mm-hmm.
We've been training mushrooms on salt, water, petris in the lab. We've collected more strains. We're doing, I do little mock oil spills. With my classes, you know, we teach how to take it out of water and then remediate it on land. But
wow, that's amazing. That's amazing.
It is cool, and it's outlined in the book. Anybody can do it. Third grader can do it, and it's taught in a way that you know that skill level is there. So what I would like to see is using that manual as a, you know, as an ignition switch to get more of our young students more active and interested in mycology. And any teacher listening or parent will know that ask your child about mushrooms and if they, you know, what their teacher is teaching them in class. And there's pretty much, it doesn't exist.
Hmm.
And when you look at the national standards, it's just not there. And they're actually removing fungi more and more every year, which is very odd. When you think about all the wonderful things that they do. So, you know, we decided to include a chapter on fungi in the classroom as a supplement for teachers, homeschoolers who want to teach fungi the way that I teach it when they come to my tours or on the farm.
Right.
They're like, wow, they're like, this is amazing. Kids have to know about this. The problem is it's not out there.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm hoping that anyone listening, you know, has a school or homeschool. It is about cultivation, but it also doubles as a educational manual to encourage students and from kindergarten all the way up through college to experiment with fungi to try to find solutions. That's what it's about.
Not to mention something to go along with the milk and the morning snack too.
Yeah, it's all encompassing. You know, it's about making mushrooms a part of your life. You know, we're here, you know, on the planet. We grow vegetables. You know, we grow tomatoes and things in the garden. And there's no reason why you can't grow wonderful medicinal mushrooms that are edible in your kitchen or right outside, you know, the kitchen window.
Mm-hmm. Our lieutenant governor is here, Phil Scott. He has a question for you.
Hey, good morning. I've been listening to some of the uses for mushrooms and wondered, you know, we have a severe phosphorus problem in Lake Champlain, and I'm curious as to whether you've done any, looked at whether mushrooms could clean up anything like that.
Yeah, and good morning. And the mushrooms are really good at mining. When you think of them as accumulators and assimilating molecules and minerals, phosphate is one of them. Now, if it's a you know, if it's diluted in water, if it's a solution, what you'd have to do, it's a little bit more difficult, but we create what we call these little filtration modules. And what we would do is to take a sample of that water, test it, and then run it through this matrix of wood chips. If you remember, we described these colonized wood chips of this fungal biomass, like mm-hmm. a big cake. And all you'd have to do is just percolate it through that filter. And the fungus is really good at assimilating those phosphates and removing it from the water, if it is in a body of water. So it's almost like making a big charcoal filter, but instead you're using fungal biomass.
I think some of our problems are twofold. Some is already introduced to the water supply, and other is being introduced from runoff from farms and so forth, and maybe a barrier-type arrangement on some of the stream banks with this mushroom fungi-type system?
And that's going after point source. That would be step one, is, you know, prevention. Cleanup is another thing. It's more difficult to do a cleanup, but installing these barriers is a really good idea, and they're very inexpensive. They can make use of local available materials, the wood chips and whatnot, but livestock, fertilizer runoff, making these trenched areas or collection ponds, bioswales, the technology is there. You probably just need a hydrologist to engineer some of the runoff and rain gardens and to do some data. But what I'm going back to is, in order to find out how much biomass you need to do like a little tabletop test unit. In other words, you would just calculate on a scale basis how much of this fungus you need according to the amount of contact time. Right, so that runoff runs through the filter. How much biomass do you need, and how long does it have to stay in contact with that fungus to do its job? And our facility is set up to do that. And you know, we've hired a new hydrogeologist here, and his job is to run these units. And we're getting samples from all over the country. We're getting mining samples. We're getting coal ash. If you remember the coal ash spill in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, what a mess. And we've got some samples from that. So, you know, if anybody wants to run samples, and especially to initiate a project like that, start with the initial data, start with a little pilot or little model, and then we can scale it from there.
Well, Tred, thanks for your time this morning. I appreciate it very much. Good luck with your book.
Oh, thank you so much for letting me speak.
Tred Cotter is the author of Organic Mushroom Farming and Mycoremediation. Phil, you may be on to the Lake Champlain cleanup pollution here.
Well, it's an interesting
darn well
subject.
Better give us credit.
Yeah, I think you know, when I started listening to the program at first, I was thinking, well, what's mushrooms got to do with anything? But certainly, yep. You learn something new every day.
See, you just got to keep listening.
That's right.
You
got to
hang
right.
in on the program. By the way, that set of headphones that you dropped when you came in, they're now, you own them.
Okay. Yeah, put it on my bill.
We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We're going to talk about health care with the Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott joining us here. We'll be back right after this.
It's time for the Addison County.